I have Plata on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Dietrich Kaltais joins me now. The award-winning author has just published a new book, Dirty Little War, a crime novel. Set in the 1920s, the main character, Huck, finds himself in Prohibition-era Chicago amidst tensions of rival gangs while he throws his lot in with a North Side gang. He gets involved in bare-knuckled fighting, bootlegging, even gaining the attention of Al Capone. I'll ask Mr. Kaltais about Huck Waller and what brought him to Chicago and to this lifestyle. I'll ask him about what makes Chicago such a rich setting for an author and how he writes. Dietrich Kaltais won the 2022 Crime Writers of Canada Award for Excellence, Best Crime Novel for Under an Outlaw Moon. He is the author of 13 novels and blogs regularly at his website, DietrichKaltais.com. This new book is published by ECW Press. We spoke just over 3 weeks ago with Dietrich joining me from North Vancouver. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Dietrich Kaltais. Mr. Kaltais, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Very well, thank you.
The book is set in the 1920s during Prohibition, and it's such a fascinating place because we have our own conceptions of it, you know, through movies, of course. The Untouchables is something that comes to mind. What drew you to this time and place? Have you always been interested in this place, in this era, say?
I think there's always been a fascination, you know, old movies and so on. This story actually started to come about when I was writing Crooked, my last novel, which is set around the 30s, and follows the Barker Gang and so on. So I came upon the story of taxi wars in Chicago that ran from the 20s into the 30s, and I just started looking into it, and it just fascinated me, and that was really sort of the spark for it.
Yeah, so this is 100 years ago, and we'd like to think, you know, we're away from a long ways away from, say, crime and corruption, but I mean, you know, you just think of the towing situation in Toronto. You know, whenever there's money to be made, there's always, you know, competing forces, and it's usually the criminal element, isn't it?
That's true, and that's funny. They had a towing outfit in Chicago that towed anything off the street too. back in the, I guess, 60s and 70s, the Lincoln Park Pirates are called. So it's Chicago's just one good story after another.
I keep thinking as I'm reading the book, Dietrich, about, you know, because we know that story of crime and corruption, say, flourishing in Chicago. What do you think made Chicago such an ideal place for that to happen?
I think it was just sort of the center of commerce and crime and corruption kind of just goes hand in hand, I guess, or around that time. There was also Prohibition, which played a big part in the story as well. So you've got all these things going on. You've got a taxi war in Chicago. You've got Prohibition, which, you know, there are speakeasies all over the place, and they're running booze in from Canada and other places as well. So there was, you know, there's just such opportunity if you were old enough, I guess, to get into it. And real jobs were a problem at the time too. Where, you know, when the character Huckabee Waller comes to Chicago, he's looking to make an honest living, and, you know, soon finds that, you know, there aren't a lot of open doors.
Yeah, you mentioned something that just struck me. You know, geographically, its proximity to the border, Chicago is much closer to Canada than, say, New York or Los Angeles.
Yes.
So that makes it an ideal place for, for crime to flourish. You mentioned our hero, Huck Waller. He's not from Chicago, is he?
No, the fictitious character, but he came from New Orleans after some trouble there. And he got on the rails and rode his way north. And, you know, there was always a fascination with the way people would just jump on trains too and travel across the country. So that sort of played into it as well. So I did all this research, and, you know, I mean, it's one thing to say, well, he'll just jump on a train and go north. You've got to actually find the trains that actually went north. And you know, did they connect? What lines were there that, you know, I mean, they don't exist now anymore. So a lot of research goes into doing something like this. And I find really I'm fascinated by doing the research, but it's really the cherry picking of what am I going to keep? What am I going to use? Like, what really, you know, in a few words, what creates a really big picture? And I'm always going for that sort of thing.
We lament the lack of newspapers in our society today. Chicago must have had just a number of newspapers for you to draw upon in the research.
And I did. I researched through many an archive. I had all kinds of photos of the era and sort of surrounded myself with that, and the music and everything else, and you just immerse yourself in it.
The other thing I was thinking about as I'm reading the book is, like Al Capone, for example. Now, I know he appears in the book somewhere later. The thing that I'm having trouble contending with is just how hard... is it to understand how well known he was? I mean, for being in the line of work that he was in, I mean, he was known across the country, around the world for his exploits, right?
Right, yes.
I mean, that sort of stuff doesn't happen today, I guess, does it?
Well, you know, at the time, the story spans a decade, so, you know, he was more or less an enforcer for John the Fox Torrio when he started out. Torrio, you know, ran the south side of Chicago, and Dino Banyan ran the north side of Chicago. So you had the, you know, the Italian gangs and the Irish gangs in the north, and they were clashing. I mean, there's more than enough to go around, but Dino Banyan just had a way of always infuriating Torrio, and you know, it just led to, so you've got a war between the north side and the south side gangs too, and our character Huck just finds himself in the middle of the taxi war and then the gang wars as well, all the while he's just trying to survive, really.
The book opens with Huck in a bare knuckle fight. I guess these aren't sanctioned events, are they?
No.
And he's told to take a dive, which reveals something about his character, because he doesn't want to, does he?
No. And you know, that's the thing with building a character like this is, you know, he gets into some nefarious things, and somehow I have to make him likable.
Mm.
Or nobody's, you know, you won't want to follow his story. You won't care about the character. So little things like that just kind of make him a stand-up person.
Yeah, I read one review of the book where the reviewer talks about how much he liked Huck. I guess you, as the creator, as the writer, because you are spending so much time with him, you have to like him a lot to continue, say, the process, right?
Sure, yeah. Because you're seeing it through his, you know, from his point of view, basically.
Yeah.
So you want to understand him, and when... I don't know how far you've got, but he meets Izzy, the homeless street kid,
mm-hmm.
and he helps him out. Throughout the book, I mean, the book follows 10 years, so Izzy kind of grows up. I'll give you that much.
Yeah.
So you know, again, just it makes him, you know, a little bit more of a likable character, I think.
And Huck grows up too, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah. There's quite a curve of the character from, I guess, you know, the most guilty thing is at the beginning, he's naive. He gets into bare-knuckle boxing and, you know, he's good enough at it, but he soon learns that's, you know, there's no long-term here. I mean, that toe-to-toe fighting, I mean, you know, that's... towing the line, that's where that came from, that stand down or strap fighting. They just literally stood toe-to-toe and started swinging.
Yeah.
Nothing graceful about it. And, you know, people would just come around the boxcars and so on, and light a fire, somebody roll out a keg of beer, and they take bets.
The thing is, I'm reading the book, that I'm finding is that you have a great ear for dialogue, Dietrich. Is it fun to write what people are saying? I mean, because for the reader, these characters really do come alive for us as we literally hear what they're saying.
Yeah, when I'm writing a first draft, I'll build the characters. I mean, the ones that I make up, and you know, through the research, I get to know some of the characters. I mean, some of the well-known characters are probably even harder to write. But there were a lot of enforcers and so on that most people probably haven't heard of. And, you know, you just find out what you can about them, and you kind of build the character through the first draft, and the characters I'm making up, it's the same thing. I'm kind of getting to know them as they evolve, and then through into the second draft, they become more cemented, and they kind of almost start speaking for themselves because they become more real, more fleshed out.
Do you have an idea as you're writing what Huck looks like?
I do, yeah. And that doesn't always come initially either, but it builds with the story. But I'll find clippings and so on and go, yeah, this is what he would be like, this is what he would look like. And, you know, I mean, I do a lot of background on them that I probably never use, just so it all kind of lines up and makes sense. And I don't start going in one direction when I was going in another two chapters before. So you really do get to know the characters as you build them.
The names of the characters are fun, too. Gorilla Al, Nails Morton, Gypsy Doyle.
And many of those are real.
Yeah, yeah, that's the fun part, too.
Yeah, about, it is.
Yeah. Do you spend a lot of time, Dietrich, thinking about how the book will be narrated?
How the book will be narrated?
Yeah, because you use a third person telling us a story. Sometimes some authors may use a different way to say get into the book. Was it always going to be this way, say?
Yeah, yeah. It started that way and stayed that way. So it kind of felt right.
Yeah, the thing is that you're telling a story that, say, you know, in the third person today, as opposed to, say, someone who might be telling the story 100 years ago. I think the language would be a little bit different, wouldn't it?
It would, and you have to, you know, I try to be careful with that. You want it to be authentic.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, who's the reading audience? So, you know, you don't want to use phrases that will take somebody out of the story or make them go, I don't know what that means. But for most of it, you know, I think people are familiar with expressions from the 20s and 30s,
yeah.
Although I don't try to hit that too hard because it kind of jumps out at a modern-day reader.
A lot of people are consuming fiction, especially via audiobooks.
Yes.
Does that play in your mind as you're writing? Is that a consideration that you make as you're writing, say?
Well, I never know if it's going to be in an audiobook, but I think if the narration is right, the dialogue is right, you just need to find the right reader for, you know, anytime I've done an audiobook, I've been involved to the point where I'll listen to the audition tapes. And we've been fortunate in just finding the right voice, like, you know, just the right narrator that just hits those nuances and just gets it right.
Carla is another important character in the book. How does she first encounter Huck?
Nickel dancing. And so literally that's what it was. She was a nickel a dance. She was a nurse. She lost her job as a nurse, and she actually met Huck while she was nursing. She fixed him up after a fight and then saw him again a few weeks later after another fight, and then he sees her nickel dancing at a little speakeasy, and he recognizes her, and at first she doesn't want anything to do with him, but you know, he's persistent. So that's how they meet each other.
For people listening to us, the term nickel dancing might suggest say dancing for money in terms of like a striptease show or something like that. This is like that song 10 cents a dance, where you go to a place and then you pay someone to dance with you, literally.
That's right. It started out as a nickel.
What is it like to build a character like her? A lot of, say, what you might find in the newspaper might be, male-centric, if you will. Do you find that you're able to find a lot about the women of the era and a woman like Carla, say?
Yeah, and, you know, throughout it, you know, she's more or less the voice of reason in a lot of the things that come later. She's a very strong female character, very central character. She didn't play by a lot of rules that were laid out, you know. Mm-hmm. She was kind of her own person, and that's probably unique to that era. I think there were a lot of, you know, there was a suffragette movement and so on, and you know, I think they're sort of coming into their own, but it was still a very male dominated time.
Yeah, history would probably be more dominant of the stories about men than, say, women, even though they did play, say, a big part in society.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's the interesting thing about Dirty Little War, is that you're able to, say, flesh out somebody like that.
Yeah, yeah. And again, you know, I came upon, you know, the nickel dancing, and I, you know, that sort of stuck, and I wanted that in it before I even knew I wanted a female character.
Mm-hmm.
So that just seemed very colorful to me, like, oh, you know, I want to do something with that. And, you know, Carla kind of came out of that, and just through the different drafts. I had, you know, so many things kind of going at one time, because the way I form a story, I usually start with one idea, and it just kind of grows from there. Where can this go from that scene? What could follow next? And then I've got, you know, taxi wars, I've got prohibition, I've got gang wars. So I've got a lot of things that actually happened intersecting, and I needed to sort of have them intersect the way they actually happened in a timeline.
I guess that's a question that you get a lot. What comes first, say, the character or the story? I guess you come across an aspect like nickel dancing or the taxi wars, and then you find a way of putting the story around those things, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like with Crooked, my last book, it followed Alvin Karpis, and that was always the central theme, Alvin Karpis and the Barkers. And I think that started, I read a book on the rock about Alvin Karpis, and I found out he was born in Montreal, so he was Canadian, and that kind of piqued my interest, but, you know.
Are you writing, I guess, because you are prolific as you are, you're writing all the time, aren't you?
Every day, yeah, yeah. Pretty much. Yeah.
What don't you enjoy about your work?
You know, that's a tough question.
Because I talk to writers all the time, you know, writing is as much rewriting as anything.
It is, and you know, I really enjoy the rewriting, the tweaking, and finding a way to make a phrase sound better. And that's, you know, I don't need a lot of words in a day when I sit down to write it. Just if what I've done is pleasing, then that works. But I like the editing process. I'm often editing a book while I'm writing another book.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, I just try to fit in the time. I mean, sometimes, I guess the worst thing about it is there's sometimes not enough hours to do everything I'd like to do. Although, you know, there's no agenda. I don't assign myself a number of words to aim at in a day, because some things flow easier. Some things just want to take their time. You know, there's sort of the other side of it too. You know, you write articles, and you do other things mm-hmm. revolving around it, and I enjoy that too. Probably not as much as, I mean, the writing, coming up with the stories, and you know, from beginning to end, that's just the cream. That's the good part. The editing is great too. I enjoy that, especially anything that can make that story better. And working with editors, you know, with that in my mind, I enjoy working with editors too. Whether I agree or not, if it's something that'll make that story better or more consistent, then let's do it.
Mm-hmm. Are you able to get breaks in, say?
Occasionally. If I'm traveling somewhere or doing something, there's a natural break, and that's fine. I mean, you need to come up for air, I suppose.
Yeah. What's your relationship with reading as a writer? I mean, you obviously have to read a lot if you're doing the research part, but are you reading things in the genre that you're writing in, say?
I do a lot of reading, not always in the genre, but often in the genre. Mm-hmm. I enjoy any book that I think is well written. Whether it's a crime novel or a biography, or if it interests me and I feel it pulls me in, then I'm all in. I listen to a lot of audiobooks too. A lot of the books, it gives me more time for the books, because I can't always be sitting down reading. Mm-hmm. I love to end the day that way.
Yeah.
But sometimes during the day, I don't have time to sit down and read. So an audiobook might be the thing.
Yeah, it's a wonderful way to consume, to get more hours out of the day, say.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the lights have to go out sometime.
They do.
And if you're not asleep, well, then, you know, you're able to, say, read, listen to a book. Somebody pointed that I used to turn my nose up to audiobooks, and which is an odd thing as a podcaster, but... somebody said, say if one were blind, that's the only access they have to literature.
That's right.
And
yeah.
So this is listening to an audiobook is just, it is reading itself. And so
yeah.
we mustn't look down on that or turn our nose on that.
I think you get used to it. And I was like that with e-books too.
Mm.
But if you travel a fair bit,
yeah,
it's great, because Your books don't weigh pounds anymore.
Yeah.
And you can read it anywhere, You've always got enough light. Like if you're on a train or a plane, it's quite handy.
Yeah, I was the same way too. And then I realized, if I wanted a book at 3 a.m., I just, do a couple clicks online, and then it's on my device.
That's right, yeah.
Or my computer, and, you don't have to leave the house.
Right. I think, given my choices, I would always prefer a print book.
Same.
And that's probably just,
yeah.
It probably just dates us. Like, we grew up with books.
Yeah.
But you've got this colorful cover. It's, you're holding it in your hand and you're flipping pages, especially if it's a brand new book. It's just a great experience.
It is. Now, you're someone, as I mentioned, who's quite prolific. Having spent a lot of time creating characters, as you have, especially the characters in Dirty Little War, do you understand why people do bad things?
Yes, I think you have to. I think you have to understand their motive. You don't agree with their motive, but you have to understand them.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing about fiction, especially. Is that your ability to be empathetic, I think, is raised a little more when you read about bad people, especially.
Yeah. And it's funny, many of them, they don't see themselves as bad. They see themselves as resourceful or something other than bad. I don't think anybody says, oh, you know, I'm a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, unless they think that's a good thing. You know, but they do what they do.
Yeah, they're just trying to make it to the end of the day, aren't they? Or make a life for themselves or the people around them.
Yeah.
Which is what everyone's doing, really.
Yeah, but you know, when you're doing it from a one character's perspective, that character, you know, Huck might look at Al Capone a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And he runs into him a few times in the book. And same thing with Dino Banyan. I mean, you know, some people thought he was nuts, you know, because he was fearless. He was just reckless. And but, you know, he was also a great singer. He would entertain some speaks, and he'd get up and sing Danny Boy. And, you know, there's always sort of an interesting side to some of these characters. So they're not, you know, they're not one-dimensional.
Yeah, there's a certain charm, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to ask, what's next? There's always a book, I guess, in the offing for you, isn't there?
There always is. Yes, I have. The next one up is called Irrenhaus. It's a German word. It's set in the tail end of the Second World War, and that's probably all I can say about it right now. It takes place in Central Europe. So it's a departure from the norm, I guess. Something different.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to finish this book. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today, Dietrich. Congratulations and continue good luck.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me on the commentary.
The website for more is at dietrichkaltheis.com. The book is called Dirty Little War, a crime novel. It's published by ECW Press. Its author, Dietrich Kaltheis. Join me on the line from North Vancouver. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunto.